There is an event that I have to tell you about. It is one that I have attended 3 times in a row, and that is the NEO Summit. Y'all, it is honestly unlike any nonprofit event experience I have ever seen. This year, it will take place on September 18th and 19th in Indianapolis, Indiana. It is 2 full days of digital marketing and fundraising content, workshops, over-the-top fun summit parties, prizes, swag, and so much more. Dare I say, it is a masterclass in edutainment. They have truly mastered the balance between learning and having a really great time. Now, I have worked with them on getting you the lowest price ticket available anywhere. You can save $600 on your ticket by using my link in the show notes. Hope to see you there. Now let's head on over to today's episode.
Follow the data. This is why I've become so data-driven over my whole career, because even long before California Symphony, when I was at those bigger institutions, Seattle Symphony, Seattle Opera, even Bumbershoot Music and Arts Festival, there was a lot of like trying to get these ideas greenlit, trying to employ a version of these strategies. And so even then, you know, dealing with what you want to do, what you want to focus on retention, you know, and so being able to really know the numbers and say, this is what the data shows. And we're so lucky that we have so much data already available to us. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just have to know the data.
Hey there, you're listening to the Missions to Movements podcast, and I'm your host, Dana Snyder, digital strategist for nonprofits and founder and CEO of Positive Equation. This show highlights the digital strategies of organizations making a positive impact in the world. Ready to learn the latest trends, actionable tips, and the real stories from behind the feed? Let's transform your mission into a movement. Hello, listeners. I am jazzed for today's conversation, and jazzed is kind of a pun for what our conversation is going to end up being about today here with Aubrey. Aubrey Bergauer is the founder and CEO of Changing the Narrative. She transformed the California Symphony during her tenure as executive director from 2014 to 2019. She nearly doubled the size of its audience and quadrupled the size of its donor base, let's go, ensuring the orchestra's long-term financial stability. Now, this is dope. You ready for this? She has since been hailed the Steve Jobs of classical music from The Observer and Sheryl Sandberg of the Symphony. And I am a big fan of Sheryl Sandberg, by the way. And she just released her first book, Congratulations, Run It Like a Business, Strategies for Arts Organizations to Increase Audiences, Remain Relevant, and Multiply Money. And we're here to talk about how you made it all happen. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for that intro, Dana. It is a pleasure to be here.
You're very welcome. I'm super stoked that you are here. So I like to like dive right into things. Can you take us back to 2014? That's 10 years ago now, which just seems wild.
Yeah. How is that even possible? I know.
Take us back a decade when you became ED of the California Symphony. And what was like the status of things when you first started?
Yeah, it is hard to believe it was a decade ago now, but here we are. And the state of the organization was financial crisis. And the board had shared some of that with me, to be fair. They didn't hide that. And so I knew that that was the task ahead. And yet the challenges, to be more specific, were not unique to that organization. There are so many cultural organizations for sure, maybe other nonprofits as well, seeing definitely declining donor base. That's true across all nonprofit right now, trying to raise more money from fewer households. That was already true 10 years ago. On the ticket side, declining audiences, aging audiences. Mm-hmm. They had been cutting. And as a mantra, you know, you can't cut your way to health. And so it was just trying to stop this like kind of death spiral they were in. Not to be too dramatic about it, but it was pretty bad. And then when I started, it was like, oh my God, how are we going to make payroll at the end of the month? Like that kind of bad. Yeah. So yeah. That was the state of things. And just from very early on, though, the reason I took the job was because there were some foundational assets that I was like, okay, we can raise money for this. I can get people on board with this. We just need to spend ourselves out of the really bad stuff. And then, as you said, the end results over 5 years, we accomplished a lot.
Amazing. Okay. So I like to give people the note about where you started from. What background did you have that led you to say yes to enter a role like this?
My whole career, good question. My whole career has been in arts management. And so I had cut my teeth at large institutions, and at the Seattle Symphony, I worked in fundraising. At the Seattle Opera, I worked in the marketing department, over all of those things as the number two at the Bumbershoot Music and Arts Festival. And I, along the way, had really started developing a lot of the concepts that probably we'll talk about today. And in whatever my scope or role had allowed, had started to see success in these different strategies. And so when this opportunity came, like I said, I thought there were some foundational assets. I could raise money for this. I always say now the silver lining of crisis is that there is more hunger and thirst for new ideas and looking at new opportunity, hunger and thirst for change. And that's what I was coming in to do. I said, I have a plan and I need a board to say, yeah, I see the plan and let's do it. And they did. And so that was really that green light to say, okay, you have the authority, you have the scope. You Amazing. Can do this. And not every board gives their ED that much leeway. Right. And so I'm really grateful to, especially my board chair there. That was sort of the background to answer your question and all of it coming together to say, okay, this is where I'm going to go. And I remember saying, this is going to be my, I don't want to call it experimental playground, because like I said, I had tested a lot of these ideas at prior organizations, but I just thought this is going to be the place where I put it all together and we're going to see how this plays out.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Okay. So I just have a question, because I'm not in the arts and culture space, and I have recently seen, maybe in the past decade, because I was attending them, the research, or not maybe resurgence, but like huge amount of attention with youth going to festivals. So like the Coachellas of the world and concerts. And were you not also seeing that at the time? Because I think about that with music from what I see. Was that not happening in the symphony space? And if so, like, why not?
Yeah, it's funny because I worked for three seasons at the Bumbershoot Music and Arts Festival, which is like a Coachella kind of. Anybody in the Pacific Northwest probably knows Bumbershoot. So there are definitely differences, but it is that kind of idea of a three-day festival. And what we were seeing there is, in some ways, what you described, yes, definitely people, like there was a rise in popularity of these festivals, but Bumbershoot had been around since the 70s. So it was actually like a really early kind of adopter of this festival model. And what was interesting in particular to Seattle was that because it had been around for so long, it used to be free. I mean, can you even just imagine if Coachella was free? And so we had to deal with a lot of, like, talk about marketing challenges. Like, how do we message that, no, these are expensive things to produce? And I mean, that's something true for all of the arts. It's expensive to produce because these are labor intensive art forms, no matter if it's a music festival or a symphony orchestra or an opera company or a theater, whoever. So that was a particular challenge there in messaging that, no, it's not free anymore, like it was 30 years ago at the time. But this model of, and this is something I think all kinds of arts organizations can learn from, that nothing beats the live performance. Anybody who goes to a music festival understands this. Like, I listen to fill in the blank artist on Spotify or Apple or whoever or wherever, and therefore I want to see them live. And that's actually a concept that performing arts organizations can really adopt of, oh no, our digital content in itself is not a money-making stream. Our digital content is the gateway that makes people want this, what I call the analog in-person experience. Yes. So anyways, kind of trying to connect a few dots here of strategy, music festival, how does this apply to other more quote-unquote traditional arts organizations?
No, that's really helpful. Thank you. And you ended up coming up with a very different donor pipeline experience. Can you walk us through what was the traditional model? And then you said you kind of pulled together everything from your previous experience at the symphony. So what was the traditional model? And then what did you implement that was different?
Yeah. So the traditional model, the way it typically works at most arts organizations, whether that's performing arts or visual arts, visitor-based, even cultural organizations, zoos, for example, botanical gardens, all of that, is somebody buys a ticket, they come for the first time. We immediately, anybody listening, you can like tell me if this has happened to you. Immediately, what tends to happen next? You get solicited for a donation. Like almost always, it seems like you get the call from Telefunding or you get the letter in the mail. And then the marketing department's like, wait. Maybe they want to buy a subscription. They came once, maybe they want season tickets. So then they start bombarding you with, here's the season brochure, here's the offer to get your subscription, right? Like, hopefully people are listening and being like, oh yeah, I've totally seen that. And that's, like I said, kind of the quote unquote typical way. And so to attach some statistics to why I think this way is broken, in classical music, this is true for other artistic disciplines as well, but pretty close at least, is that of first-time attendees, of those people who buy a ticket and come once, 90% never come back.
Wow.
90%. Exactly. That is a churn rate that is so alarming. And it, like, put a pin in that, because that's part of the impetus as to why I thought there's got to be a better way. Like, if we just change that one statistic, that is going to set up everything for more success later. Okay. Second stat I want to share. Once people do become season ticket holders, the drop-off rate after the first year is 50%. Okay. And then once people do become donors, this comes straight from Association of Fundraising Professionals. So this is all nonprofit, not just the arts. It's up to 81% do not renew, never come back. So we've got 80% of donors, first-time donors not renewing, 90% of first-time ticket buyers not coming back. I mean, these stats I just thought were horrifying when I first learned them. And that set me on a path of asking questions. Why is this happening? What do we do about it? So that led to, we can talk about user experience research and all that sort of strategy, but to your question here of this different donor pipeline model, I thought, okay, we have got to stop the over solicitation too soon. Because yes, some of those first timers, well, 10% will come back. We got to fix that. We got to make it higher than a 10% retention rate.
Yes.
Once they subscribe, we've got to make sure that renewal is more than half of them. Keep that season ticket package the following year. And of donors, we've got to get that renewal rate higher. And so a good statistic that I also knew is that once somebody is a second year season subscriber, you get over that first year cliff is what I call it now, the first year cliff, you get over that first year cliff hurdle, then all the research in the field says they are now your top prospect to donate. And so I started putting all this together and I said, all we have to do is wait. And waiting is not my personality, I will say that, but being strategic definitely is. And so I thought, okay, we need a systematic customer journey. And I feel like now the words like customer journey, audience journey, user experience, those are words we use a lot. In 2014, especially in arts and culture, no.
And especially not, in like digital, definitely not.
Exactly, yeah. And so going back, I thought, okay, at the time it just seemed... I don't know, radical is probably too extreme, but it was different to say, okay, what's the plan when somebody comes for the first time? All we're going to do is invite them to come back again. I now know this is called behavioral repetition. I didn't know that 10 years ago. Let's just try to get them to come back again. Once they start forming a habit, or at least the beginning of a habit, we know data in the field says if you can just get them back for a second time within 12 months of that first experience, they are so much more loyal. Their lifetime value skyrockets, all these things that we want to see. Yeah. And so I thought, okay, they're a first timer. The only thing we want them to do is come back. Let's invite them back. Let's give them offers. Let's, what, you know, whatever, pull out all the marketing stops to get those first timers back again.
Was there like a time frame of when you wanted to get them back again?
Yeah, we said if we can do it within 12 months, we tried to get it sooner just to add some urgency, but the data shows if you can do it within 12 months,
okay,
then they're kind of in the system.
Okay. So I'm a first time person and I bought a ticket. I go to the performance, then within the next 12 months, I'm hopefully coming back just for another repeat one-off performance.
That's exactly right. Yeah. We're not trying to sell you season tickets yet or anything like that. And there was a whole bunch of things we had in place. You know, what's the email sequence afterwards? What's the postcard, you know, multi-channel here, all of that. And then also, like I said, what we're not doing, not soliciting, not, we're not inviting them to the gala. We're not inviting them to season tickets. We're not sending the donation letter yet, all those things. Okay. So then once somebody comes back a second time, then, like I said, the data shows they are primed. They're primed because they're starting to build a habit. So could we sell them on a small season ticket package, a 3-concert package? You came twice in the last year, not a big leap to then move that behavior to 3 times a year, that sort of thing. So we came out with like a banging offer, 3 for $99, that kind of a thing where it's like, okay. And then from there, it was, we've got to do everything we can to get over that first year subscription cliff, get more than 50% to renew. And then the numbers are really amazing. True for all arts organizations. Once somebody is a second year subscriber, those renewal rates are like 75%, 80%. Once they're a third year subscriber, it's like 90%, right? Like the whole equation changes. And then, like I said, by their second year, the research shows they're really primed for a donation ask. So this isn't, I call it the long haul model, but that's the change in the donor pipeline. And then that is not the only strategy that led to the success you shared at the beginning, double the audience, quadruple the donor base, but it was a big, big part of that success for sure.
That's incredible. You're making me think about my parents who they live in Sarasota, Florida. It is a very rich arts community.
Yes.
And they have been season ticket holders for the local Florida Studio Theater for years. And they do it with another couple friend of theirs. And it's now been, it's like date nights.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And like double date nights. And they go out and I got literally, I can't. And the same thing with UCF. My college, it's funny because they're still local and I'm not. And they still get season tickets and go to the games, even though I'm definitely not there anymore. And I'm not even local to go with them. They go to my alumni games because they have friends now that they met yes. when I was there in school. So to your point, getting over that first year and then you're hooked because you become like a super fan.
That's exactly right. That is a great way to put it. Yeah, it's building loyalty. Super fandom is, of course, like the Holy Grail. And what you just described adds this other element of its community building. And yeah. that's the part that, I mean, every marketer listening to this knows, like, if we can start selling community, we're selling something way, way deeper in terms of like human connection than any product or service any of us offer. So yes. I just love that, like, naturally, those are the words that came out of like, oh no, they have friends. It's a habit. They have friends, super fan. All these things are like, check, check, check. That is what yes. we want.
Yes. And I want to get to the test that you did on UX with the younger demographic in a second. But first, I just want to like wrap up the donor pipeline here and talk about why are not more organizations shifting to this model if it's so profoundly different in the results. And I might have a slight clue. You did mention that your organization was like under fire to bring in funds. And you said a big word, and that's you had to have patience in this new model. Is that why people don't do it? Because they're just like, no, let's just send everything and see what sticks.
I think you're not wrong, Dana. I think to add some nuance, I mean, yes, of course, what you said is correct. It's mixed, I will say. There's definitely a growing number of organizations adopting this model. It's a big part of the work I do today is helping organizations adopt this strategy. And so there is good news. It is being adopted more and more. I think part of it is because of the challenges of the industry, and more folks and leaders are saying, okay, yeah, there's got to be a better way because we know what the graph looks like if we keep mm-hmm. doing what we're doing. So, okay, that's the good news. But I think to dig into, yeah, why resistance to change, right. change management is a whole category to talk about, fear of change for sure. And I think for some organizations, you know, when things are scary or uncertain, or there is more financial strain, our natural reaction as humans sometimes is to, you know, exactly. Both of us are like white knuckling, like it, for people, I know nobody can see us, but just white knuckling, like, yeah, grab on, hang on. And so, you know, combating that tendency is a real barrier. And there is some money attached. Sometimes people do come once and then give a donation when they're asked. We know what those renewal rates are. We just talked about right. it. But, you know, so the short term, like, oh, am I going to lose something is a real yeah. driver. But to say, it doesn't even take that long. It's called the long haul model. But to say, if we just wait 1 year.
Yeah. And if you're doing the same thing, then nothing's going to change.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but like I said, more and more people are saying, okay, no, I think it's time to get. If we want to be around for a couple of years, we need a couple year plan, not a 6 month plan. You know?
I love it. And I love tech. So if you don't mind, would you share what CRM platform were you using for like your audience donor management and email tool?
Yeah, I get this a lot. And it's funny, I'll answer it, but I get asked about tech stack all the time. And I think for arts organizations, there's not a silver bullet. Like I don't have one that I highly recommend. At the time, the CRM was Vendini, which was specific to the arts. Okay. It's not even in business anymore. It was acquired by somebody else, yada, yada. It was not like the perfect source for data, which I say because mm-hmm. so many arts organizations think like, I need the right CRM. And I don't know that there is a right CRM. So instead you have to say, no, we're going to be disciplined about the data, no matter the tools in our toolbox. Yeah. Email was MailChimp, so standard for so many of us. And that was a good tool for us to be able to do segmentation and drip campaigns and things that again, 10 years ago, weren't as common. It was definitely a practice, but not as common as now.
Awesome. Okay, cool. And then what are your tips? You had a board that seemed like they were willing to kind of take this risk with you. What would be your advice to organizations that maybe don't have that gung-ho approval from boards to move forward? How do you overcome maybe that risk-averse mentality?
follow the data. This is why I've become so data-driven over my whole career, because even long before California Symphony, when I was at those bigger institutions, Seattle Symphony, Seattle Opera, even Bumbershoot Music and Arts Festival, there was a lot of like trying to get these ideas greenlit, trying to employ a version of these strategies. And so even then, you know, dealing with what you want to do, what you want to focus on retention, you know, and so being able to really know the numbers and say, this is what the data shows. And we're so lucky that we have so much data already available to us. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just have to know the data that is available in the studies that have been done. So that's thing one. And I would say thing two is, I am a huge fan of iteration, which means I'm a huge fan of pilot testing. And when you call something a test, wow, does that lower that barrier, that resistance, the threat a little bit more? Instead, it's, we're just going to test it. We're going to try this for 3 months, 6 months, a year, pick your time frame and see how this goes. And suddenly when you call something a test, it truly is. It just takes the pressure off. But then also, it helps us remember that these things aren't set in stone. Absolutely. Our job as leaders is not to hit a home run, Hail Mary every single time. Our job is to help lead through what are new
ideas and
iteration. That would be impossible
expectations.
Exactly. Impossible. And I think to just say one more thing on this topic, it is also human nature to, when there's complex problems, want an equally complex sweeping solution. It is just human nature, but to know the biases is the first step to overcome them. So to say, no, we will iterate. We will take some small steps here. We will test, measure, refine, repeat. That to me is the formula for growth in a successful organization.
Yes. And you did some testing with your website, which I think is fabulous. That was called an experiment. I did some reading. And it was called Orchestra X Experiment. And this was to kind of like reinvigorate millennials and Gen Xers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so it was updating, which I thought was so smart, the UX of your audience experience on your website. Can you share, for those that aren't familiar, maybe like UX, UI, what does that mean? And why did you do this?
This was also 10 years ago. I had no idea what user experience was. I did. I now know that that is what is called, and that is what we did was UX research. I didn't know it at the time. So why was because of that statistic we already shared, 90% of first timers not coming back. So we had the retention plan in place. And then Orchestra X was like thing number two I started when I got there, and there being the California Symphony. And we thought, okay, if 90% of first timers aren't coming back, like retention, sure, and our efforts and what we can control, sure, we're working on that part, but there's got to be something else we're missing. And so we thought, okay, let's ask them about it. Let's ask newcomers about their experience. And so we put out the call. We said, you know, millennials, Gen Xers, and again, it was 10 years ago. So Gen Z, I don't know, how old was Gen Z then? Not quite old enough to be going to the symphony, or if so, not in a way that, I mean, now Gen Z's young adults.
I'm a millennial and I'm 35, so I was 25.
Yeah, exactly, right? And so we thought, okay, millennials, Gen Xers, that'll be our target for this. And we put out the call. We said, if you're the type of person who likes live entertainment events, is smart, educated, identifies as those things, identifies as somebody who is culturally aware, but for whatever reason, you just don't go to the symphony, we said, we want to hear from you. And so we put out that call, and even that alone, just posting about that, got a lot of response. And what we did, we said, okay, for this research project, you can come to as many concerts in the season as you want for $5 each. Not free.
Oh my
free
gosh.
Has no value. It wasn't about making money. It was about research. And the reason why $5 is because, like I said, free has no value, but also we wanted them to go through the purchase path on the website. And we said, so you have to buy something in order to go through the purchase path. So basement low price of $5. And we said, but there's one concert in particular that's required just so we can have a shared experience from which to be the basis of the discussion focus groups that happen later. So that was the setup. And sure enough, when we got to the focus group on the website in particular, so many people said things like, wow, your website reads like inside baseball. And
wow.
It became really clear. We just had so much. And actually, it's funny. We were just talking about tech. Comments like, there is so much technical language and jargon on your website, talking about an orchestra, not Silicon Valley, right? And those kind of comments were so eye-opening. And the more we probed and drilled into that, it turned out that Yeah, we're using all these words like concerto and aria if you're an opera company, and things like that are words that are very familiar to people who have spent, hand raised, decades in classical music, not familiar to smart grown adults because it's not taught anymore. And it was a real like crossroads moment for me of, Aubrey, why do you preach that the decline in public arts education in this country is a big reason for declining audiences, which so many of us in this sector do believe that. And yet I had done nothing to change how I talk about the product, how I talk about the experience. And so, like I said, this real crossroads moment where I thought, Aubrey, you either get your head out of the sand and do something differently about this in response to this feedback you're hearing, or like we said, just keep doing things the same old way. Right. And so, yeah, we've started making changes. There were also comments like, we want to know, is this concert, is it a romantic comedy or a tragedy? Talking about an orchestra, not a play, right? But is it a romantic comedy or a tragedy? And we realized like, oh, like they can't tell when, like most orchestra websites are just, you go to the landing page for the program and it's, here's the program, composer, composer, composer. And it just became so clear that, right, not everybody knows these composer names. Not everybody knows the typical length of a concert. That was even another, just so many easy fixes. You just attach the length of the pieces, like put it on the website. These are copy changes. These are so easy. Yeah. And so, especially at the beginning, we still, it was the first year I was there. We were digging out of that financial hole. We had no money, no money. And I was like, but copy changes are free. And it was amazing. The results that we started seeing just with changing the copy in response to these things I just shared. Less vocabulary words, define them when we use them. We started even just linking pieces of music to their Wikipedia page because we were like, somebody in the group had suggested that. They're like, I looked up every piece on your season on Wikipedia, which was very extreme. And most customers won't go to that great length to learn. Like
they were just trying to understand what type of experience am I about to have.
Yes, 100%.
How am I going to feel after I'm leaving? Is it going to be heavy? Is this light?
Yes, yes.
Is this like I'm going to have a cocktail or I'm going to need to like talk about this for 30 minutes?
No, you're totally right. Because, and I've now learned like a key part of user experience research is how does somebody feel? And what we learned is that they felt intimidated. They felt unwelcome. I mean, God, these are words that you do not want associated with your brand. And even just on the question of what to wear, there was a whole dialogue of so many people assume that quote unquote younger folks want to dress down. And that was so clear. They're like, I just want to fit in. What is the expectation? So I know if I need to dress up or not. Right. And so it just, again, so many eye-opening comments. Don't want to feel unintimidated. Don't want to feel unwelcome. And I was like, well, no wonder why 90% aren't coming back. I don't go back to places I feel unwelcome and intimidated either.
I remember my first time going to Broadway in New York City was, I was in high school. We happened to be, I was part of a gospel choir. I don't think I've definitely never shared this.
I love this. Keep going.
We traveled up the States all the way from Florida to New York City. And we stopped at a lot of churches along the way. And when we reached New York City, we had a nearby church that we were going to be singing at. And we got to like tour around the city for a little bit. And my mom chaperoned this trip. And she said, would you like to go see The Color Purple? And I had no idea about Broadway. And I think literally my response to my mom was, do we have anything to wear? Like, do we have to be fancy?
Yeah.
Which was completely opposite of usually Broadway is such a mixed bag in New York City of what people are wearing. Mostly it's very casual. But that was one of the first things that I asked was, oh my God, like, I don't know. Like, can we even go?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it just uncovers like, these feelings of if you don't know, you don't know. And there's no shame in that. And that is on us as arts organizations to, I now say, fill in that knowledge gap, make those expectations clear. That is on us as organizations. That's not on the consumer. And I think so often we try to put that on the consumer, like, we'll Google it. And it's like, no. In 2024, customers don't take that long to research these things. Right. Like, no way. Right. So that's on us as organizations. But I love that story because it's so real. And so if I can just say one more thing to be positive about this, we learned, and this is so fundamental now to my work, through this user experience research. Okay, so we talked about all these negative emotions, nervousness, concern, all these other things. When we talked about the music itself, the emotion that everybody expressed was awe. I felt awe seeing 80, 90 people perform together on a stage, seeing something on Broadway for the first time. It is larger than life. I felt awe, and it was like everybody in the room. And every time I've repeated this kind of research, it's something, a moment like this happens. And that for me just cemented
a great word.
The art is not the problem. It is, talk about user experience, research, all these strategies, retention, it's everything around the art that really needs to be optimized to run a successful business.
Yes. Whenever you get in the room, like you're there and usually it's beautiful, whatever you're seeing. Love that. So what was the result afterwards of changing that? Did you see an increase in younger listeners?
We did. And so it's interesting because we didn't set out just to get quote unquote younger audiences. I mean, that was who we were targeting for the user experience research, but a lot of time, let me do this another way. I'll do what typically organizations do and then what we did instead. So typically when we have this conversation of we need new audiences, we need younger audiences, it's, oh, let's do more Harry Potter in concert. Let's do another Star Wars program, you know, that kind of thing. Nothing wrong with those concerts. Those concerts are awesome. They're super fun. You go see the movie on the big screen, the orchestra plays live, like not throwing shade on that. However, what happens? 90% of those people or more in those cases for those concerts don't come back again. And so it doesn't, like to me, I was like, this does not solve the fundamental challenge. So to connect some of these dots, I realized, I was like, it's not the art that's the problem. No problem playing Harry Potter, but that doesn't mean play less Brahms. Like we can have all of this coexist because it's all really, if we believe in the power of our product and the strength of our product, which I do, and I felt like that focus group research was affirming, it's like, No. All these genres can coexist. Nobody said I need more Beethoven or less Beethoven. Nobody said I need more Harry Potter or less Harry Potter. Instead, it was, okay, if the art's not the problem, let's stop tinkering with the product to try to solve these challenges. Instead, let's start talking about the experience that people are having. So when we started making those changes, the website copy changes, even on site, can we create an experience that's more welcoming? Can we just work with the venue to allow people to bring drinks to their seats? Okay. Seems small, but nobody wants to gulp down their drink. They just paid $20 for an intermission. Yes. You know, it's like, and so even working, like fighting that battle with the venue to say, no, this really matters. And then, you know, you make all these little changes. This is another argument for iteration. You make all these little changes and then together they really make a big difference. So in that first season, coming out of financial crisis.
True. The drinks are like $25. All the time, it's like, you have 5 minutes to dial this. Like,
chug, chug, chug. Yeah. Talk about a terrible experience. Yeah. So, okay, we started addressing all of these things. And then at the end of that first season, we had increased ticket sales by almost 20% overall. First time buyer retention had gone up from that 10%, 90% no return to, I think 20% in that first year of their first timers were coming back within 12 months. Eventually we got it to 30% pretty reliably. Like no matter what concert it was, we knew around 30% we would have back. That's 3x the industry average. So we were pretty happy with that. So, but that was that first year, and then put in place with that the retention plans that really started rocking and rolling by year two, because it does take a little time. Mm-hmm. That first year that we came off of, it was like 20 years of deficit budgets before I arrived. That first year we balanced the budget.
Wow.
It was a hustle that first year. But then the good news for anybody listening to this, it does get easier. That is the beauty of momentum. That's the beauty of like anybody who likes a flywheel concept, right? Like it does get easier, but getting it started, you know, it means change.
So good, Aubrey. Thank you so much for sharing that with us and breaking that down. That's incredible. And I hope it's inspiring and people are taking some notes on things that they can maybe change or pass forward some tips for their organizations. That's incredible. Where can people find your book where they can dive into more details on what you did?
Anywhere you buy books, it's out now. It is called Run It Like a Business. And I will say, it's strategies for arts organizations is the subtitle to increase revenue, multiply money, all those things. But anybody listening to these concepts, hopefully you can see, I try to think outside the arts a bit here and really take inspiration from the business world and how do we apply it to our work. But anywhere you get books, aubreybrookauer.com/book if you're not sure, but otherwise Amazon, you got it.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Okay. Everybody go get it. I cannot wait to check it out. I want to jump into the last section, which is ask and receive. Who do you think is doing a great job at marketing that you think should be highlighted on the show, either a brand or it can be an individual?
When I was researching the book, I was really looking for so many interesting examples and it didn't make the book. So I want to share it here is National Park Service. So I don't know if anybody follows them or not. Run, don't walk if you do not follow them on Instagram already. They're feed is so entertaining, which is probably not a word you would think was going to come out of my mouth with National Park Service. And what do we know about National Parks? Their visitorship has really skyrocketed since mm-hmm. lockdown and continues to skyrocket. And their social media could be kind of boring if you think, like, it could be pictures of trees and rocks and stuff, I guess, but it's not. And so they have just done an excellent job of this idea of
totally going and following right now.
Yeah. Really just like entertaining, thumb stopping content, just really like, I don't know. Here I am talking about them. Their picture, if their feed was all rocks and trees, I wouldn't be saying this, you know?
5.7 million followers, National Park Service. Whoever manages your account, I am, oh my gosh. Of course, the Super Bowl, the first thing I find, there's, I don't know if these are squirrels doing touchdown with like the positions of the funny animals just here for the commercials. And it's like a otter fumble with a bear like covering its eyes. These are so funny. Holding, and it's two bears holding each other.
They do a good job. I don't know who runs that account, but that person is, that person must be fun at a dinner party. I'll say that. They're pretty clever.
I love it. I love it. That's amazing. Okay. Secondly, what is one thing that you would like to ask for help or support on? I'm assuming regarding the book.
I was going to say, book at this point, it's the whole hustle right now, but anybody who has any interest, it means a lot. We talked about where to get it, but run it like a business.
Awesome. Are you doing any like private trainings too? Do you do workshops and
yeah, consulting? Thank you for asking. Yeah, I have several online courses I offer. I now have the Run It Like a Business Academy. So for those organizations that say, yeah, this sounds great, we need a little help and structure around creating the change, implementing this model, that's exactly what the Academy does. It goes deeper than what I was able to do in the book. Really is meant for staff. So the book is meant for a broader audience, anybody who has any interest in these topics. The Academy is for anybody who says, okay, yeah, I'm ready to bring this to my organization. So thank you for asking.
Of course. Awesome. And then lastly, where can listeners connect with you?
Online, aubreybergauer.com, on social media, at Aubrey Bergauer. I would love to see you all there.
Yay. Aubrey, thank you so much. Congratulations again on your book, and can't wait to dive in and check it out.
Thank you, Dana. It's a total pleasure.
Can you tell I love talking all things digital? To make this show better, I'd be so grateful for your feedback. Leave a review, take a screenshot of this episode, share it on Instagram stories, and tag Positive Equation with one E so I can reshare and connect with you.